Okay. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's nice to see both new and unfamiliar faces. I want to begin tonight with a slightly more personal note than I usually begin with. I want to say just a couple of sentences about this series of three lectures that I'm going to be giving. In some ways, the series of lectures that begin tonight, I have been working on and off for my entire adult life. There was a moment when I was an undergraduate when I woke up in the midst of angst as only college students can do it. Tortured about a relationship that had ended, confused about what I should be studying and what I should plan on doing when I finish studying, just basically kind of generically tortured. And I had this moment in which I realized, you know, I have had a pretty intensive Jewish education, and right now in this moment when I'm trying to figure out, to be grandiose, the meaning of life, I literally don't have the first clue how Judaism would answer any of the questions that I now face. It was an amazing moment for me of disappointment and heartbreak, realizing that I knew an awful lot of stuff, but I didn't feel like I had a sense of what it meant to really see the world and to see my life through a Jewish lens. Things like, what does Judaism say about what it means to be alive, to walk through the world as a human being? Do human beings really matter, even though it seems in countless ways that human beings don't matter at all? What can we realistically accomplish in the world, and what is just so much kind of Pollyanna fantasy? What are we expected to do with our lives? What kind of human being does Torah, does Judaism, does God want and expect me to become? I felt like I didn't have a clue how to answer any of those questions. And in many ways, it was that process that began the sort of journey of my life of trying to figure out how we can talk in Jewish language about the big questions, about what it means to be alive. I spent much of the past few months working on a book that tries to open up some of these questions, and the three lectures that I'll be presenting are kind of three of the pieces I've been working on in trying to think some of this out. And I will be very eager and grateful for people's feedback. One sentence about tonight's talk, just to sort of share a piece of excitement, is sometimes you set out to give a shiur, to teach a class, or to give a lecture, and you basically know, to write a chapter, and you basically know, I'm starting with this, I'm ending with that, and it's just a matter of getting there. This lecture, for me, actually ended up upending an awful lot of what I thought I knew and what I expected to say when I worked on it. And that, I'm hoping I'm finally mature enough to find that exhilarating rather than threatening. Mostly I found it exhilarating. What I wanted to think about was, we know, that a variety of Jewish thinkers over the history of Jewish culture and civilization have speculated about what it means to say that human beings are created in the image of God, and in particular, what it is that is the image of God. What are we saying about people when we say they're created in the image of God? But I wanted to ask a different question, which was, what does the Bible itself mean? What does the Bible itself mean when it employs that language? What is the theology of Genesis about the meaning of personhood? What does it mean to be in the image of God? And to just telegraph for a minute where I hope to go, I want to sort of make two points that are really kind of the core of where we'll move in this presentation. One is that where human dignity and significance are concerned, the Torah represents a radical critique of much of the ancient Near Eastern world, and it is a deeply egalitarianizing, democratizing view of human dignity. I'm going to flesh that out at great length. But that's sort of point number one that I want to try to explore. And the second is that the Torah's view of Tzelem Elohim, of the image of God, is profoundly concerned with human responsibility towards and for the rest of the created world. Okay? So that's where we're going to be kind of journeying tonight. So, Genesis 1, verses 26 to 28, three of the most famous verses in the Hebrew Bible, in which God famously says, you have that as source number one in your packet, let us make the human being in our image after our likeness. And then, verse 28, one of the most controversial verses in the history of Western civilization, especially in the last 40 years since the rise of what's called environmental ethics. We'll come to that in the second part of tonight. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, and rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on earth. Other translations with which you may be familiar use the phrases subdue and have dominion. Right? This is the new JPS translation, but you may be familiar with the formulation of subdue the rest of creation and have dominion over. And one of the things we're going to have to do tonight is figure out what those terms actually mean. In recent times, something that almost never happens in the world of scholarship has happened, which is there is a kind of virtual consensus among academic biblical scholars about what this text seems to be saying. It is attributing a royal dimension to human beings. Being created in the image of God, in other words, means being given the special role of, as one scholar puts it, representing God's rule in the world. It means being God's viceroy. We will discuss this at some length. Interestingly, in Jewish culture, it was Rav Sadia Gaon, more than a millennium ago, who first suggested that what Genesis 1 means is simply what it says. I, God, create human beings in my image so that they rule the world. That, he suggested, is not just a consequence of being created in the image of God, but that's actually the meaning of being created in the image of God. What it means to be created in the image of God is to be created to run the world. Okay? As we'll see later on, the Hebrew verbs here have very explicitly royal connotations. Rada, the yirdu, that is about ruling, other people call this to have dominion, takes language from a political context. That word usually refers to what an earthly king has as authority over non-kings, the enormous majority of the human race. Here, that word is taken from a socio-political context and transferred to the relationship of humanity to the rest of the world. Now, I'm just going to sort of try to anticipate something and try to deflect it for now. I understand that the word kingship and royalty gives many people the willies, and for good reason. We're going to get there, okay? We're going to get there. The willies is a philosophy term. Third year of grad school. Now, okay? So, but the point is, a king's relationship to a king's subjects is in some way parallel to, according to Genesis, human beings' relationship to the rest of the created world. Again, a political term is now transferred to the relationship of human beings and nature. Similarly, the word kavash, subdue, expresses the idea of bringing something or someone under control. Whether bringing someone under control by violence or by some other means depends on context. Okay? So at minimum, what Genesis 1 appears to be saying about human beings in the world is, to quote a scholar named Richard Middleton, the right of humanity to spread over the earth and make it their home. More expansively, it suggests the right to domesticate the animal world and to cultivate the earth. The purpose of being created in the image of God, in other words, is to rule the earth on God's behalf. the Torah's view of what it means to be created in the image of God is that we are vice regents, earthly delegates, appointed to function in some godly role in nature. Now, just as a little footnote, I want to point out that there is some disagreement among scholars, as I kind of alluded to before, about whether this is the consequence of being created in the image of God or the meaning of being created in the image of God. Right? Is it, oh, created in the image of God means something else? Maybe I look like God. Right? In a post-Maimonidean age, you say that in, like, terrifying, right? Maybe in some ways I look like God. Maybe there's some quality in me that's like God. But the consequence is that I am entrusted with ruling the world. Or it's simply the meaning of Tzelem Elohim, as Saadia Gaon suggested. I want to take this one step further, which is what you have here is the Bible's first moment of a theology of what's called imitatio Dei, the imitation of God, that human beings are given the role of behaving in godly ways, just as Genesis 1 is primarily a story about God forming the world and filling it. Forming and filling, you could map out, if you study Genesis 1 closely, that's the process. God makes stuff and then puts stuff in the stuff God makes. Right? Human beings, similarly, are given the task of forming the world, that is, stopping the chaotic nature of the world and filling it by reproduction. It is the first moment in the biblical theology of imitatio Dei. Just as God forms the world and fills it, so human beings participate in the process of forming the world and filling it. By the way, this requires a little bit of understanding of biblical theology, because we are in some ways corrupted by the medieval Jewish philosophical tradition, and Christian and Muslim, right? We think that creation in theology means God takes nothing and turns it into something, whatever that means, right? But actually, in large parts of the Bible, what creation actually means is taking chaos and making order out of it. So that's what human beings on some level are asked to do as well, to participate in the process of undoing the chaos of the world and organizing it. Now, here is the point that I want to really kind of emphasize in part one of tonight, because it is totally radical and it's crucial, and it's a window into the ways in which understanding ancient Near Eastern cultures and civilizations can at times be an imperative for understanding what the Torah is trying to say. Right? And without knowing it, we miss what the Torah is actually doing as a text. In the ancient Near East, across a variety of civilizations and cultures that we know in the ancient Near East, it is the king who is created in the image of God. King X is created in the image of God Y. One of the things that means is King X has some kind of metaphysical authority to rule over everybody else. Right? So the king is in the image of God, and all the rest of us are decidedly not. The king, in other words, is God's representative or intermediary on earth, and it is he, and it's always he, who mediates God's blessings to the world as he sees fit. For Genesis 1, in dramatic contrast, it is not the king who is created in the image of God, but it is every single human being who has ever lived. It is not the king, but rather each and every one of us who is an image of God. What this means, and if I could underline this point 1,000 times I would, is that the Bible is attempting a kind of radical democratization of ancient Near Eastern culture and theology. Right? In the world of Babylonian civilization, for example, ancient Babylonian civilization, the king represents God's rule, and it's a kind of metaphysical consequence of that, that everyone else is subject to him and is supposed to serve him. Genesis 1 is a kind of almost explicit repudiation of that theology. We are all kings and queens, which means, I hasten to add, that none of us are. Right? If every one of us is sociopolitically a king, then also none of us is a king, because we are radically equal. In Genesis' picture, in other words, human beings are meant to rule the animals, but we are never meant to rule each other, at least not in some ultimate or metaphysical way. This is a conscious subversion of the theology of much of the ancient Near East. What it means is, to speak kind of political theory language for a second, or political theory meets theology, that all political arrangements, all earthly social arrangements are radically relativized. They are not ultimate. Right? In the ancient world, God sets up the monarchy as part of the creation of the world. The monarchy that governs a civilization is itself primordial. It is part of the fabric of the universe. Genesis 1 dismisses that completely. There is no political arrangement that is primordial. And if you go on and read the early prophets, you discover that, in fact, the Bible goes out of its way to emphasize that the monarchy is an earthly creation. And at least one strand of the Bible thinks the monarchy is a function of human stubbornness in wanting destructive political arrangements. Right? But it's very, very important to understand this. That means that none of us is metaphysically constituted to rule over any other of us. This is a kind of metaphysical, theological brief for human equality. In other words, to say one more way, the Bible refuses to sanctify any political arrangement. In Babylonian thinking, right, some people are just meant in a cosmic way to rule over others. That's the theology of the Babylonian Empire. The king is in charge, everyone else serves him. Genesis 1 lets go of that rather forcefully. Okay. I have no idea what just happened here. Aha, okay, thank you. So, there's another piece that I want to mention here, which I think is quite striking. And here I'm indebted to Nahum Sarna. We will come back to this in a little while. The Bible goes out of its way to emphasize that in the animal kingdom and in other parts of creation, species are created liminam or liminehem, according to their kind. There is a multiplicity of species. Now, if you're reading Genesis carefully, and you're really paying attention to kind of the literary devices of this text, you notice that when we get to humanity, there is no invocation of liminam or liminehem, according to its kind, because there is only one kind of human being. Right? There is not a built-in hierarchy of the holy people and the non-holy people. Right? That is very kind of, very basic. There is no sense in which human divisions are ultimate. That's not to say they're insignificant in biblical theology, but they're not ultimate. And related to that, which if I could scream this for the rest of my life, I would. Genesis, as a book, makes a conscious choice to insist that humanity as a whole is primordial, but the Jewish people are not. You might expect a myth of origins that a people puts forward to be about how we are built into the fabric of creation as God's unique special treasure. Genesis 1 refuses that. Right? It is humanity and not the Jewish people. It is Adam and not Abraham who is the subject of the first moment of creation of humanity. So whatever theology about Jewish peoplehood, the election of Israel, the special role that the Jewish people have in God's unfolding drama in human history, whatever theology one develops around that, the background picture says, yes, but the concern and love of God is for all humanity. That's the background. The background for covenant is creation. Okay? Now, I also want to make one sort of other point here that I think is interesting, and this is a little bit of an interreligious polemic, although I have to say that it's actually contemporary Christian scholars who have made this point. There's only three times for a claim that we insist is so central to biblical thinking. It's striking that the notion that human beings are created in the image of God only appears three times in the Hebrew Bible: Genesis 1, Genesis 5, and Genesis 9. And I just want to sort of make what I think is an interesting observation about that. The two times that human beings, that the text reiterates that human beings are created in the image of God, the two times are after the sin in the Garden of Eden and after the sin that leads to the flood. What the Bible, I think, is doing is affirming that humanity is created in the image of God in those moments, precisely as a way of telling us that the divine image that we are or that we have, depending how we want to think about this, doesn't dissipate or disappear on account of human sinfulness. People can violate the divine image, but they cannot abrogate it. Right? After each moment of, you might even say from the theology of Genesis, God being devastated by human recalcitrance, by human failure, the text then wants to return and emphasize, oh yeah, and you know what? God created human beings in the image of God. Right? That dignity is never lost or abandoned. And neither, right, presumably is the mission and responsibility. Okay. Now, there is another text in the Bible that does not speak about the image of God explicitly, but that seems to share the theology with Genesis 1, and there is kind of all kinds of scholarly debate about what the relationship between these two texts are, and that is Psalm 8, which is the second source on your source sheet, and you can sort of look at it closely in the interest of time, since this is sort of a long presentation. I won't read it. Psalm 8 contains a paradox that lies at the heart of all Jewish theology and spirituality. That paradox is, on the one hand, we look at the vast cosmos and sense that we are totally paltry and insignificant. What is the human being that you, God, are mindful of us? That's verse 5. What are we, the text asks? And the answer is clear, even though it's implicit, nothing. Nothing at all. And yet, this is the other piece of the paradox, the Bible insists that we are also of ultimate significance, that we matter in cosmic and ultimate ways. God takes note of us, and more, God appoints us to rule over and govern the earth. And here again, you'll find a whole proliferation of verbs that are royal in context. Right? Okay. So even as we are conscious of how tiny and insignificant we are, and often feel deeply that we are equally aware in the project of this text of how of our immense power to shape the world. And if anything, this kind of goes without saying, I think, but if anything, modern discoveries only accentuate how small we really are. Right? Just to sort of keep this in mind, right? Most modern scientists now estimate that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. That's big. Right? And if you ever have a sense of kind of anthropological arrogance, to coin a term, just go hang out in a planetarium. Right? And realize how utterly tiny we really are. Now, Psalm 8 does this in an incredibly interesting literary way. I want to suggest, and here I'm borrowing from a Christian scholar named Peter Craigie. In verse 4, the text says, "When I behold your heavens, the work of your fingers, ma'aseh etzba'otecha," that is a conscious choice not to say the work of your hands, more common, ma'aseh yadecha. What does it mean to say that the world is a function of God's fingers rather than God's hands? Well, on the one hand, right, it might say something about what Robert Alter calls, I think, something like the delicate tracery of creation, how beautiful and careful it is. But on the other hand, what it suggests is, think about how utterly tiny the vast, enormous cosmos is from God's perspective. For God, it's just like literally like playing between God's fingers. In other words, the theology here, and again, this is all about learning to read closely, we are tiny in comparison with the heavens, which are themselves utterly tiny in comparison with God. We are unimaginably tiny. That's the work of verses 4 and 5. They want to stretch the cord as tight as they can. We are nothing. We are minuscule. And the text goes on and does that in other ways too. Ma'enosh ki tizkerenu, ben Adam. These Hebrew terms suggest frailty, vulnerability. Think about, for example, in modern Hebrew, you can talk about someone being chole anush, meaning weakness, right? These words suggest utter vulnerability. And notice, again, reading closely, the text says, ma'adam, not mi'adam. What is man, not who is man? A term of kind of, as Nachum Sarna again points out, a term of scorn, a term of derision. Not even, we're nothing. We're just a thing. Right? So the cord is being stretched really tight on one end. We are utterly insignificant. And yet, in the very next verse, everything changes. And again, language that is suggestive of royalty emerges in full force. Words like crown, glory, and majesty. Verbs like mashal, to rule, which are used in other places in Psalms to refer to God's rule over the earth. There are other literary pieces here that maybe if there's time later in the question and answers, I can talk about. Now here's the problem that we have, I think, very often in reading texts that are very familiar in the culture. Right? When we are familiar with words, their power to shock and jolt us is often lost. And so it requires important work to kind of defamiliarize ourselves with what seem like commonplace texts. That is, verses 5 and verse 6 are so commonly quoted. What is man that thou art mindful of him? And yet, a little lower than the gods. They're so commonly quoted, and they're so familiar, that the fact that the transition is absolutely abrupt and incoherent is lost on us. Right? What is man that you are mindful of him? And yet, and but, you have crowned us to rule over all creation. Just to understand how radical this is, look at source 3 for a second. A direct parallel in Psalm 144, I'm on page 2 here. O Lord, what is man that you should care about him, mortal man that you should think of him? Right? The same question. And what's the answer? Adam lahevel dama. Man is like a breath. Yamav kitzel over. His days are like a passing shadow. That is, as it were, the right answer to the question that we've been set up with in Psalm 8. This is why biblical text should always be read as a kind of intertext, right? One text in conversation with another. Because Psalm 144 is the right answer. What is a human being? Nothing. Now, you return to Psalm 8, and you realize it has set up the same question. The world is vast and amazing. What are we? Only everything. Right? The shock of Psalm 8 emerges when you look at the parallel in Psalm 144. What I want to suggest here, in other words, is many people are familiar with the by now cliche Hasidic tale about human beings being obligated to carry two slips of paper in their pocket, right? One of which says, the world was created for my sake, and the other one of which says, I am but dust and ashes. That Hasidic story, consciously or not, is rooted in verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 8. That is a biblical claim, not a Hasidic claim. The Hasidic tale is merely a kind of concretization of the theology of Psalm 8 that says, what are human beings? Vastly insignificant and utterly central to the unfolding of God's plan. Now, when I was reading a bunch of academic commentaries on Psalm 8, I came across a commentary by a scholar, a Christian scholar, who I actually think is very interesting on many issues, a man named John Goldengay. And John Goldengay says something that I want to quote here only because, with due respect to a scholar, I think it is so profoundly wrong that it's important to emphasize that. He says, human beings have a choice. Should we look at our insignificance or should we look at our significance? And the text of Psalms bids us look this way rather than that way. Right? That the thrust of Psalm 8, he says, is to progress from the feelings of verse 5 to the theology of verse 6. Are we significant or are we insignificant? We are significant. That, I want to suggest, is totally unwarranted in the text and is sort of a bad way to describe our experience and ideally the tradition of Jewish theology. Here, words in a different context from Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik are extremely useful, right? Which is that Jewish theology, in contrast to Hegel, affirms dialectics without synthesis, which is a fancy way of saying usually you have one pole, another pole, and then a resolution. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's theology, in his interpretation of the tradition more broadly, you have one pole, you have another pole, and good luck to you. Right? That's what it means to be alive. And what I want to suggest is what Golden Gate succumbs to here is the temptation to dissolve complexity rather than embracing and wrestling with it. And if I could say one thing about Jewish spirituality in general, when it's kind of in a more mature version, it's about embracing complexity and finding language for it rather than dissolving it with simple answers or platitudes. Right? And Psalm 8 is an amazing example of that. Right? It basically says, yeah, you know what? You want me to give you a coherent metaphysical answer to do we matter or do we not? Yes. You don't think that's neat metaphysics? Great. I'm not doing neat metaphysics. I'm asking you to figure out how to live in the world with complex experiences, with a theology that is complicated. Now, here, I want to say something that is extremely robustly theological, because I think it's important to understand what Psalm 8 is saying. The words, ma'adam vateda'eyu, what is a human being? And I don't know how to translate this. That you are mindful of her? Or what is a human being but you are mindful of her? But what the claim of this verse seems to be is that the source of our value is in being known by God. It would be the case, ma'adam, and but, vateda'ehu. But, you are known by God, and that is the source of infinite significance. Now, I want to quickly emphasize, this does not mean that we don't matter unless we live in conscious, explicit relationship with God. Theologically speaking, we are known by God, whether we ever realize it or know it or not. And I want to emphasize another piece of this that I think is at least as important, and it really is the theology of Genesis 1 and Psalm 8. What it means to be known by God is to be made responsible. What it means to be human is to be responsible. If we take seriously what we saw about Genesis 1 and then the reiteration of that royal language in Psalm 8, what it means to be known by God is to be given responsibility to run the world in a particular way. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Now, that's sort of amazing. You know, there are all kinds of ways you can think about in theological or spiritual terms. Why do people matter? And we could have a whole kind of, we could go around the room and have different versions of that, theological and not theological. But the theology of Psalm 8, which I think is quite dramatic, and is really kind of captures and encapsulates something very powerful about Jewish theology and spirituality, is we matter because we're responsible. We matter because we've been given responsibilities. In the language of the Gemara and Baba Kama, Adam mu'ad la'olam. A person is always responsible. Now, many environmentalists have had extremely harsh things to say about the Bible and about the history of Christian interpretation of the Bible in particular, and have placed the blame for environmental degradation squarely at the feet of the Hebrew Bible. In 1967, an essay that gave birth, really, to the whole project of environmental ethics, a historian named Lynn White famously wrote, and here I'm going to quote one sentence, that according to the Hebrew Bible, quote, God planned all of this, that is, creation, explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes, end quote. Thus, all but absolute license is found in this text for human beings to do what we want and how we want to with the earth. This is an extremely interesting claim, although I have to say I think it's also totally wrong. And interestingly, you know, since the publication of that essay in the 45 years that have passed, it's kind of universally acknowledged, more or less, right, that it's wrong. But I want to actually do the work of figuring out why. And I also want to emphasize that my point in doing that is not to do apologetics or to rescue the Hebrew Bible from environmental critique, but actually to prod us to think about what it would mean to actually take the Hebrew Bible seriously. Right? So, does the Bible really think that creation exists in order to serve humanity? And that and that alone is a source of its value? The answer, which I think is self-evident from a reading of Genesis 1, is emphatically no. If you look at the sources I've collected in Source 4, again and again, before humanity comes on the scene, like a refrain, Genesis keeps repeating about each aspect of creation that God sees it, ki tov, that it is good. As Maimonides already pointed out in The Guide of the Perplexed, this is not late 20th century apologetics. As Maimonides points out in The Guide of the Perplexed, creation is declared good prior to and separate from the arrival of human beings onto the scene. I would like to add, by the way, that if anything, the opposite is the case. Because the Bible, I think very consciously, does not say about human beings in particular, ketoth. It's as if the jury is still out. The Bible says at the end of day 6 that God looks at the whole thing and sees that it's very good. But human beings never receive that evaluation. Human beings on some level alone are never described as very good. And if you keep reading a little further in Genesis, you can figure out why that is. Right? Because God has taken an enormous risk and it hasn't worked out so well. That in itself is worth kind of spending a lecture or a year on. Now, what's more, Genesis 1 repeatedly emphasizes, this is the flip side of the argument I made before, repeatedly emphasizes and seems to revel in the fact that God created both vegetation and creatures of every kind, liminam or liminehem. This is true of, and now I'm in source 5, seed-bearing plants and fruit-bearing trees, living creatures of the sea, birds, wild beasts, and cattle. Source 6, God blesses the creatures of the sea and the birds of the sky with the very same words that God blesses humanity. Be fertile and increase and fill the world. Among other things, then, when you read Genesis 1 closely, one of the many things you have is a veritable theological hymn to biodiversity. By the way, I think that's pshat of Genesis 1. The insistence, again, that is a simple meaning of Genesis 1, of each piece being declared of itself, ketov, that it is good in God's eyes, and the emphatic return to diversity, liminam, liminehem, more and more and more. All of this, again, to return to Maimonides' point, is prior to any human being being on the scene, or even based on Genesis 1, having crossed God's mind. Nevertheless, the language of ruling and the imagery of kingship, as I said before, is understandably troubling to many of us, aware as we are of how kingship so easily becomes despotism, exploitation of the weak, etc. Now, I'm not really interested in defending paradigms of kingship or monarchy, right? But I do think it's important to think about, not in this context, what does kingship and monarchy look like in the real world, but rather, what does the Tanakh understand to be the ideal meaning of kingship and monarchy? Right? What is the Torah's ideal of how a king behaves? And so, if you look at Source 7, Source 7 and Source 8 are a kind of pair in my mind anyway. Source 7 is from the book of Ezekiel. Chapter 34, where Ezekiel unleashes on the biblical kings of Israel. You have not sustained the weak, he charges, healed the sick, or bandaged the injured. You have not brought back the strayed, or looked for the last, but you have driven them with harsh rigor. Selfish rulers who do not care for the lost, the ill, the vulnerable, come in for the prophet's withering assessment. Right? As fundamentally living antithetically to how the Bible understands the role of a king, which is to care passionately and diligently for that which is under his hand. In no place in the Bible is it ever suggested that the king, by being declared the king, has the authority to exploit, degrade, dehumanize anyone or anything under his power. Psalm 72, in contrast, whereas Ezekiel is an attack, Psalm 72 is the opposite. Psalm 72, a prayer for Solomon, is a kind of fantastic picture of what kingship ought to mean. The king should be blessed with justice and righteousness. Let him, Psalm prays, champion the lowly among the people, deliver the needy folk, and crush those who wrong them. Let him behave in such a way that the righteous may flourish in his time and well-being abound. The king, we learn, saves the needy who cry out, the lowly who have no helper. He cares about the poor and the needy. He brings the needy deliverance. Now, there's one point here that I really want to emphasize, which I think is actually interesting and very easy to miss, which is the noble, compassionate king's rule over his people is conveyed by the Hebrew word yerd, the word that is the same root as radah, have dominion, in Genesis 1. So if you think for a moment that Genesis 1 thinks dominion equals domination or exploitation, you have looked at the wrong intertext, meaning you have compared it to the wrong text, because what Psalm 72 makes clear is radah, in the context of monarchy, means compassionate rule, where I am preoccupied with the well-being of that which is under me. So, in other words, Genesis 1 and Psalm 8 establish human beings as rulers. Ezekiel 34 and Psalm 72 establish what kind of rulers we are intended to be, compassionate and concerned with our most vulnerable subjects. And if you return for a minute to what I said at the beginning about how this is not just about human beings and how they treat other human beings, but primarily in this text, human beings and how they treat their subjects, which is the rest of creation, this text is a dramatic insistence on human responsibility for the well-being of all of creation. Now, even leaving aside all of this language on royalty and kingship, being God's delegates presumably means striving to rule in a God-befitting way. And as we've already seen, the God of the Bible is, to borrow a term from a contemporary Bible scholar, a thoroughly creation-friendly deity. Right? A God who keeps looking at this and at that and at this and at that and saying, Ki tov, ki tov, ki tov, ki tov, liminehem. All of it. So to be given the role of a delegate is, on some level, to be asked to rule as one imagines God would if one actually takes Genesis 1 seriously. Dominion, in other words, is not domination and is not exploitation. On the contrary, it is about being a mediator and a conduit of divine blessing, of the goodness of God to the fullness of creation. Psalm 8 makes this clear in another way that I think is actually kind of striking, which is the middle of the psalm that we saw emphasizes that human beings have been given this royal assignment to run the world in some way. But what is it enveloped by? The psalm begins and ends with a dramatic outburst of praise to God, who is the ultimate sovereign. The literary structure of Psalm 8, in other words, creates the praise of God as the frame through which all human power and authority needs to be understood. Or to put that in somewhat less schmaltzy language, human power and authority are never ultimate. They are always a borrowed sovereignty. Right? They're always, I don't know if that's a good formulation, but they are always given temporarily. And they are judged by where the psalm begins and where the psalm ends, which is, God, it's you, it's not me. It is God's will for creation, in other words, and not our own, that we are directed to enact. Exactly not what Lynn White famously argued. Nowhere does the Bible say, oh, human beings, you really matter, now do with this as you will. Adiraba, right? On the contrary, what the text actually suggests is, knowing God's view of the created world, now govern accordingly. But dominion without recognition, this seems to be the point of the psalm, or the point of the frame of the psalm, dominion without recognition that we are not ultimate can easily disintegrate into domination. If it's really the case that human beings are the be-all and end-all, the center and basis of all meaning, then it's very hard to resist the language of domination and we do what we want. Now, I just want to, because I think this text is kind of interesting, briefly point your attention to another suggestion that this is not just a kind of late 20th century or early 21st century reading. If you look at source 9 on the last page, commenting on the verse Hashamayim Shamayim Ladunai Ve'aretz Natan Livnei Adam, the heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth God gave to man, to human beings, Ibn Ezra, 12th century, wonderfully says, I'll just read it in English again for time, the ignorant think that humanity's rule over the earth is the same as God's rule over the heavens. But they are mistaken because God rules over everything. The meaning of "but the earth he gave over to humanity" is that the human being is God's pakid, or steward, over the earth and everything that is on it, and she must act according to God's word. Right? In other words, this is actually a classic 12th century interpretation of these ideas, not a particularly modern one. Now, I want to complicate this picture just a little bit as I start to run out of time, which is, crucially for the Torah, human beings do not just stand over nature, but rather we are also thoroughly embedded in and part of it. Right? Often theology has lost its way around this and has basically talked as if nature is kind of like a backdrop for the only thing that matters, which is God's relationship with humanity. Except I think Genesis is actually very clear that on the one hand, human beings are different. And I would suggest that any kind of attempt to do ethics that denies human beings are different is ultimately totally self-defeating on its own terms, right? It's hard to tell people they don't matter and therefore they should be more responsible, which is the mistake of an awful lot of environmental discourse these days, right? The incoherence of the moral conclusion of deep ecology, right? Because we're just like the rest of creation, we should become more responsible in the way we behave. Well, the fact is you can only talk to human beings about being more responsible. That's sort of the point, right? But the claim is that we are different from the rest of the natural world in some ways, but also thoroughly embedded in and part of it. Genesis 1 signals that in fundamental ways we are of a piece with the animal kingdom, which in some ways it took us Darwin to help us internalize. Right? Human beings and animals are created on the same day. There's no separate day of creation for humanity. The entire animal kingdom, which includes human beings, emerges on the sixth day. And, as I already mentioned, they and we are given the same blessings of fertility. Genesis 1 ends by assigning human beings and animals the same diet, the same vegetarian diet. It is only after the flood, seemingly as a concession to human weakness and a kind of human need for aggression, that permission is granted for humanity to eat meat. And even then, with a caveat about blood, which is again a way of saying, as Tikva Frymer-Kensky famously notes, a way of saying that hierarchy is not the same thing as domination. Now, Genesis 2 will go on and remind us that human being and the rest of the animal kingdom are made of the same stuff. Right? We come from the same material. And even more basically, Adam's very name is suggestive of his absolute and irrevocable connection to the earth, Adam and Adama. Our earthliness, in other words, is not something that we can or should escape or transcend, Neoplatonists and other philosophers of the Middle Ages notwithstanding. Right? As Genesis envisions it anyway, the human situation is both one of commonality with, and at the same time responsibility for, the rest of creation. Limits are placed on human use of the earth from the very beginning, and I'll just give one example of what could be many. The text seems to assume, and this is sort of striking, I have to say this never really crossed my mind until recently when I read someone else pointing this out. The text seems to assume that even after humanity, in verse 28, has been told that it has dominion over the whole world, the next verse seems to assume that it needs to be given permission to eat grass. So if you think dominion means that you can do whatever the hell you want with the earth, how do you explain the fact that God then needs to say, oh, you know what, you can eat that? Dominion doesn't mean that. Dominion doesn't mean, yeah, do with it as you want. You know, es gesunter, hey, enjoy yourself. It doesn't mean that. Right? Because still, explicit permission is needed. And even, as I mentioned already, when the eating of the animals is permitted, Genesis is quick to set limits, insisting that we must not eat blood. Now, the language of stewardship, right, has come under a lot of sort of fire and controversy in the world, especially of Christian theologians interested in ecological questions. But I think it's important in this context to at least sort of say emphatically as possible, as is clear from Ibn Ezra, that stewards are decidedly not owners. Right? Stewards are precisely those who are accountable. Part of what it means to be human is not to be an owner, but to be accountable. And in Jewish theology, one of the great paradoxes, one of the boldnesses of Jewish theology is to insist that being accountable is a source of joy rather than anxiety. That's the meaning of the rabbinic phrase, simcha shel mitzvah, the joy of being commanded. Joy of being commanded means being responsible, being accountable is a source of joy rather than anxiety. There is a place where rabbinic theology and, for example, Martin Luther live at an unbridgeable divide. Right? Being obligated is for Judaism a kind of a source of delight, even as it's also an enormous burden. The problem with the notion of stewardship, I would suggest, is not that it authorizes human exploitation of the earth and abuse of the animal kingdom, which it emphatically does not. The problem, rather, is it's not clear to me that we've ever taken it seriously enough to try it. The approach that I've laid out, I want to sort of be honest and clear about this and sort of unapologetic about it, overcomes one form of anthropocentrism and emphatically insists on another. It overcomes the form of anthropocentrism that we'll call crude anthropocentrism, that is, the claim that everything exists for us and that we're therefore free to consume and dispose with it as we will. But it affirms another form of anthropocentrism, which is, in contrast to the rest of creation, human beings are responsible and answerable for our actions, and it makes sense to speak of our responsibility and our answerability. That is, in conclusion, right, another very fundamental way to understand the democratization of the notion of Tzelem Elohim, the notion that every human being is created in the image of God, and not just the king, means not just that the king is accountable to his local deity for his behavior, but rather that every human being in the world is accountable to the one creator of heaven and earth for her behavior. Thank you. I think as an experiment tonight, I'm going to take like 3 questions at a time and then see how that goes.
Is there any moment in Tanakh where man...
The answer to that question already is I don't know. But yeah, go ahead.
Continue.
Yeah, go for it. And I'll say I don't know again.
Tanakh, where man is rebuked for the abuse or oppression of nature as opposed to the abuse or oppression of man, and if not, why not, according to your thinking?
Great, okay, thank you. Other comments or questions or thoughts? Yeah, Penny.
How are we supposed to square the we are nothing with we are made in the image of God? If God does suggest that God is also insignificant. You know, I don't understand how we're...
Suggest that God is insignificant? Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
We are, you know, the self-esteem and we are nothing, we are insignificant, we are minuscule, bump, all those things. How is God up to, and are we supposed to see God also?
Okay, great. One more? Yeah, Zach?
You focus heavily on Genesis 1. I'm hoping you could bring in Genesis 2 more and how that fits into it.
So, Zach, yours I'm going to kind of deal with very easily. Come back next week. I'm going to talk about Genesis 2 at some length.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about Genesis 2 at some length. So, is there a moment in Tanakh where human beings are rebuked for their treatment of nature? I would say 2 things in response to that. Much more common in the Hebrew Bible is the insistence that nature itself responds to human immorality and evil. It's not about the abuse of nature, but it is about nature's being part of, and this I have to confess, right, I think it's very hard for those of us, you know, kind of like contemplating tsunamis and other forms of horrible disaster to even think about how we could make sense of these ideas. But the notion that, let's put it positively and then negatively, that all of creation participates in praising God, a very important theme in the Psalms. And the negative side, creation rebels when human beings stray.
The Shakespearean sense of a microcosm and a macrocosm.
Not sure. Think about that. Is it a macrocosm or a microcosm? It's that somehow, that's another dimension of a kind of fellowship between human beings and creation, is that on some level, again, this is language that I find very hard to figure out how to make sense of, moving beyond literature to kind of my own world, that human beings and the rest of creation together live in a kind of fellowship of createdness.
But I think that's nature serving man.
No, I don't know if that's nature serving man. I think that that's...
Or God's purpose in shaping man as a center of creation.
But, yeah, it may be, actually this is like for a different lecture that I don't feel yet qualified to give, that human beings, one of our roles in the theology of the Psalms is to be the priests who help bring the praise of all creation to God. Maybe for a different discussion. Now, Abby's... Oh, by the way, and also, there are a couple of moments where it seems like, I think in Leviticus 20-something, right, a moment where God makes it very clear, if you behave badly and you're kicked out of the land will then get the rest that you haven't given it. That's already very close to what you're talking about. That is a kind of theological sanction of ecology, not just that the land is punishing you, but the land is being given what it needs of which you have deprived it. I'm not convinced of that, by the way. I don't know if that's right, but we could talk about it more. I'm not there yet. It's not fully cooked in my mind, to be honest. Now, Abby's question of if we were created in the image of God and we're insignificant, does that mean that God too is insignificant? So here I think it's very important to understand that I don't think that human beings being created in the image of God means that we can extrapolate everything we say about humans to God. Nor does it mean that we can extrapolate everything we say about God to humans. Human beings are not omnipotent, should not be, and will never be. God does not have to go to the bathroom, does not, should not, and will never have to. I say that crudely, but that's sort of the point, meaning there are aspects, there's no claim that human beings and God are pure mirrors of each other. There is a claim that something about us is either, depending on, again, whether you think the image of God is the meaning or the consequence, is either reflective of God or is given a task that is godly. But I don't think it means anything as radical as all that. That said, it is like an interesting controversy in academic Bible scholarship about whether the simple meaning of Genesis 1 implies that God has physical form. That's for another lecture series, and we'll sort of keep Maimonides tied up in the corner lest he come kill us, right? But even that doesn't mean that human beings would be a simple reproduction of God. It would mean that there's some, right, however tenuous, parallel there. So, yeah, I don't think that question, the premise of that question, I don't think is an accurate premise of what the Bible means and doesn't mean by image. Is that clear? Okay, great. Let's take another set of three. Please.
Mm-hmm. We're talking later on in this about the chasm between the Kohanim, Levi'im, Israel, and even in the relationship itself, we're talking about the difference between woman and man, who is Shonba.
Great. Okay. Great. Glad you asked that. A question that, you know, I can dispense with in like two sentences, right?
I think you speak to what is exactly the role that human stewardship is playing in creation, from either a theological or ecological perspective, but like what, from outside the perspective of human furthering, like what good does it do? What is being furthered about nature that we're hoping for from human involvement?
That's a really great question and a really hard one. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and one more?
Presenting the human does not being bifurcated into a living Ahab, but I chose bifurcated because we're then separated, like the Adam-Tav separation is like so stark, and we're grappling with that so much here all the time, so I was curious about maybe like in the words, how mehem is applied to the species, but I don't know, in modern Hebrew mean is associated with that other division, so I'm curious.
Okay. Wow, these are really hard and good questions. Avi's question is one of the central questions in Christian environmental ethics these days, right? It's like really actually the central debate, which is there any, you know, this is an interesting kind of, I'll deal with this question first only because it allows me to ramble without answering it, which is my favorite way of being in the world, which is to say, some people want kind of core theological metaphors or models to yield very concrete implications and repercussions. And in the Christian world, those who want that are usually the ones who say, yeah, but the stewardship model doesn't tell me what I should do about questions X, Y, Z. Right? Other people want to say, that's not the job of a core theological model. A core metaphor is not halakha l'maaseh. It is not like, here's what you should do as a result, but it is rather a way of articulating an orientation towards. Right? Now, I happen to be more sympathetic to the latter approach, A, because I'm not sure that theology ever intended to be halakha l'maaseh, and B, I'm not sure that biblical texts can do the work of poskening questions for us around this kind of stuff. I think the question of what is the theology of what human beings can accomplish on behalf of nature is one, to be honest, that I've been thinking about a lot, and I don't have a very good answer, other than working towards its thriving and continuation. And I want to give a concrete example of what I mean by this. There is a very interesting debate between two contemporary philosophers. One of them, Holmes Ralston, has famously said, in a world where species are killing each other and rendering each other extinct, our job as human beings is to stay out of the way. To which another Christian ethicist, Christopher Southgate, has said, wait a second. If you believe in the theology of Liminehem Kitov, maybe the answer is that one of the tasks of human beings is to fight extinction, period. It's to preserve biodiversity. Not just to preserve biodiversity from American oil companies, but to preserve biodiversity within nature itself. I don't really feel remotely qualified yet to figure out how to even think about that, but I think it's an interesting example of trying to figure out exactly this, which is, you know, if our role is more than setting limits on ourselves, which would be sort of like paradoxical, right? If our role is more than that, then what is it exactly? And that's one interesting frame that's out there that I think is worth thinking about more. Now, in terms of equality and inequality, so I think that in general, the Bible does this thing, which you can say again is a kind of paradox, and if you want, not you, I mean if one wants, you in the third person, if one wants kind of like clear resolution, the Bible is not really so interested in that, which is there are all kinds of ways in which, on the one hand, there are dramatic statements of equality, and on the other hand, there are sort of concessions to or realizations that lives in tension with the reality of human non-equality. There are halachic examples of this, and right, some biblical texts say that only the Kohanim can't eat certain foods. Other biblical texts say all of Israel can't eat those foods. Now, the rabbinic tradition is committed to insisting that those texts are saying exactly the same thing. But what I think is actually interesting, in a way, is that, so on one level, the text is wrestling with, wait a second, if you're talking about absolute human equality, let's collapse all hierarchies. On the other hand, the text is saying, of course we're not going to do that, because human beings live in civilizations that have some hierarchies to them. Now, again, if you want an answer of yes or no, it's very hard to get that from the Bible. In a similar way, right, the Bible affirms the election of Israel and the absolute equality of all human beings. Is that a simple theology? No, it's very complicated. But I think that that's in some ways what makes the text kind of interesting, Now, about man and woman, I think that, you know, a lot of the readings traditionally in Western civilization about the sort of supposed superiority of man over women are too simple. I'm not suggesting that there's radical gender egalitarianism, although I will point out that Genesis 1 is very clear that it is male and female who are created B'Tselem Elohim, something the authors of the Zohar might have contemplated longer. Right? Right? Now, I think that that's actually, you know, a very important thing to first keep in mind, right? Human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. That is the kind of theological claim of Genesis itself. Now, very often people say things like, well, Eve is created from Adam. Therefore, according to Genesis 2, Zach, you see I'm doing it. According to Genesis, Eve is created from Adam. Therefore, she has to serve him. Really? Okay. As long as I'm willing to accept that theology, as long as you also at the same time are willing to say Adam is created from the earth, therefore he has to serve it. Right. Okay. So now, okay, can I, you want to hear my answer to this? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I'm just going to throw this out there. Rav Kook read the Torah. And he said, you know, it's very clear that if I read Genesis 1 and compare it with Genesis 9, I realize that in the Messianic age, I'm supposed to be vegetarian. To which some of Rav Kook's students said, you know what? Why not have a foretaste of the Messianic period now and be vegetarian now? Rav Charlap and others. Right? So in other words, let's anticipate the Messianic period by enacting it now. Now, when does God allow human beings to eat animals? After a moment of failure. When does God say that man rules over woman? After a moment of failure. Now, if the permission to eat animals is a concession to human weakness, perhaps the construction of sharp gender distinctions where one gender rules over the other is itself a concession to weakness. And following the reasoning of Rav Kook, I would suggest that the theology of Genesis 1, and I would argue Genesis 2 also, but certainly Genesis 1, is that the messianic ideal is absolute gender equality. And as a concession to human weakness, God allows there to be gender division. Now, that would mean that if it's a concession to human weakness after an episode of failure in the messianic age, there will be absolute gender egalitarianism. And some of us, following Rav Charlap, will say we are committed to enacting a moment of the messianic promise now and being absolutely gender egalitarian. That is the theology of the Hebrew Bible, in my view. Right? To assume that God's response to a moment of human failure is the articulation of God's ideal for all of human history, say in good Jewish language, lo nireli. I just don't think that's right. Now, is what I just said the necessary and only plausible reading of the book of Genesis on gender? No. Okay? But is it a good example of reasoning by analogy from what Rav Kook and his students do about vegetarianism? I think it is. Yeah, take a few more. Yeah, please.
I'd like to suggest that Genesis 2 sort of suggests the answer relative to the whole issue of man's responsibility vis-a-vis the environment. When the Pasuk says, Le'ovda, Shomra, I hope I'm not anticipating next week.
Go ahead.
Le'ovda, I'd like to suggest this man's responsibility is to develop it. Shomra, I'd like to suggest is to keep it from overdeveloping.
Okay, let me say a couple words about that in a minute. Yeah, please, thank you. Yeah.
What does gender egalitarianism look like?
What does gender egalitarianism look like? Nice. Not like contemporary society, I'll tell you that much. Yeah? Anne?
Yes. I don't know quite how to frame this, so forgive me. But
no apologies.
You made it, the statement that God is, that human beings are made in God's image, and you made it quite clear that that does not mean that we are a replica of God, that there are, I mean, God is in the bathroom and so forth. It seems to me that there is one portion of man that could replicate God, and that is mind. The human beings, it seems, through evolution, there are parts of human beings, structure and body and so forth, that become less important or they change and they use. But there's one part of human being that seems to constantly grow, that almost seems infinite. That mind is infinite, the capability of mind is infinite, the search for knowledge is infinite. Could this be the replication of God?
Great. Okay. Thank you. Wow. To the question of Le'odah L'Shomra, I would say basically, yeah. I'm not sure L'Shomra means only to keep it from overdevelopment, but it certainly would include that also. But here's the main point I want to make, and I didn't want to get kind of lost in this in the lecture. I think what I'm suggesting is that the temptation to say, oh, Genesis 1 has this notion of human domination and exploitation, and Genesis 2 comes to counterbalance that, I'm not sure that's true at all. I'm actually suggesting that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 on this issue are extremely closely intertwined. Right? And are actually on some level saying the same thing. That's one of the reasons I didn't want to talk about Genesis 2. Because Genesis 2, right, you can go to a nice Jewish environmentalist conference and they'll hand out Genesis 2 and everyone will say, oh, Judaism is wonderful, talk about the Torah and the I want to say that's Genesis 1. That the text people think they should be embarrassed about is actually about this very thing. Now, of course, you know, I understand that people are skeptical about whether the Bible means this because we live in an age when seemingly a majority of American religious leaders are more afraid of environmentalists than they are of destroying God's earth. So I understand the skepticism, but what I'm really suggesting is that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 here are of a piece. And you're really just sort of, in a way, affirming that. Now, let me take Anne's question, third question first. So here, I want to speak very personally for a moment. What you said, in a way, is a version of Maimonides. Maimonides, God of the Perplexed, Book 1, Chapter 1, right, makes the claim that human reason is Tzelem Elohim. Human reason is the image of God. Now, he's particularly interested, human reason directed towards the study of metaphysical truths. He is, after all, a philosopher in the Middle Ages, right? But, so that general direction exists in Jewish thought and held by a pretty significant figure, obviously. I want to be honest with you about why I have enormous misgivings about attempts to isolate this aspect of human beings or that. I mean, you might have said, what about the human capacity for love? What about the human capacity for, right? Okay, now, what makes me very nervous about that is that when you identify one characteristic of human beings and say, that is Tzelem Elohim, Let me just finish it again. Okay, that is Tzelem Elohim. You run a very, very dangerous risk, which is there is always someone who is thereby described as not Tzelem Elohim. Right? So you have a theology that says what it means to be created in the image of God is to have the capacity to reason. So the irony is that we are only a few steps away from Peter Singerland, where people who have severe, severe, irreversible brain damage, people who have extremely, extremely advanced Alzheimer's, people who are infants born with severe brain damage, they're not entitled to any of the claims of human dignity. So, now, I understand that many people who want to articulate this kind of theology obviously don't want those implications. But Let me say it in a more abstract way. I am very resistant to any philosophical move that searches for dignity-conferring characteristics. Because there is always someone who is excluded by that discourse. I think that actually theology needs to take people with intellectual and physical disabilities seriously in a way that it has never remotely adequately done. I want to say that very emphatically. So when Maimonides says that, it makes me very nervous. I also want to just emphasize that I think it's not biblical. And that's okay, but the Bible, I think, is very clear that it is the human being who is the image of God and not this or that aspect. In other words, there's a language that is used. You know, Rabbi Yuval Sherlo, a prominent Israeli rabbi, recently wrote a book about Tzelem Elohim in which he keeps referring to Tzelem Elohim Sheba Adam, the image of God in man. That's fine, but it's not biblical. I would say Tzelem Elohim Shehu HaAdam. Right? The image of God that is the human being. Rather than saying this or that, it is not this or that, it is the entirety of the person. And also, honestly, in the history of religion, we have had more than our share of people insisting that there is some aspect of us that is divine to the exclusion of our bodies. That's not biblical, and it's also pretty damaging.
Can I just respond? You assumed I meant only reason. I think that in man's search for knowledge, we have reached the point where we are aware that all comes from mind, love, sense of responsibility, reason, knowledge, how the body works. Everything comes from the brain, from the mind. So that's why I think this is the most spectacular.
I understand, I think, where you're sort of driving. It's still that still makes me very, very nervous. In a different conversation, I would say I still don't think mind and brain should be so equally innocently made a positives of each other. But it still runs the risk to me of saying this aspect of Tzelem Elohim and the rest of us is not. I understand how deeply you want to resist that. I'm just not yet convinced that you can really avoid that consequence. But we can talk about it more. I'm happy to talk about it more. Now, what does gender egalitarianism look like? Well, I want to say this only about that, which I'm going to just say in advance. I'm not answering your question. And the reason I'm not answering your question is because I don't know fully how to answer it. But I will tell you something about the conversation I'm committed to having about how to answer it, which is that it includes women as equal partners in that conversation. And it is not about men granting the right to women to speak. It is about women speaking. And I think anyone who tells you that they know now what a gender egalitarian culture would look like is fantasizing. We don't know. We don't know what it means for child rearing. We don't know what it means for jobs. We don't know an awful lot about what it means. I think what we know is some general directions where things go. And it means questioning some assumptions about... I wonder whether we can say that just as Genesis 1 claims that no political arrangement is ultimate, whether Genesis 1, by saying Zachar Nekeva bara otam, is also saying no gender arrangement is cosmic, ultimate, or primordial. If we could get to that conversation, we have gotten very far. But I want to emphasize, and this in a way goes to the refraction of Avi's question, right? It tells me no halakha l'maaseh, no concrete implications of how to do it. But for me, anyway, it's one of the reasons I worked on creating this institution, it is about insisting, let me say it in a very simple way. The Bible talks about human beings becoming nefesh chaya, living beings. And famously, Targum Yonatan, some of you have heard me quote this word, Targum Yonatan translates, one of the earliest translations of the Bible into Aramaic, translates a living being into nefesh mimalala, right? A speaking spirit. I think that we cannot assert, on the one hand, that humanity means the capacity to speak and tell women to be quiet. That is an abomination. So all I have to offer about egalitarianism, and you know, for those who you know want us to be kind of like prophets of what it's all going to look like, I hereby apologize and concede I don't have a clue about some of the biggest questions, but I am committed that that conversation is not about men holding all the power, having conversations about what women should be allowed to do. That is not an acceptable form of discourse. It is about a conversation that includes men and women as Zachar and Nekeva bara otam, equally created in the image of God, and trying to figure out what it means to share both the privileges and the responsibilities of being human, which includes religious duties, moral duties, professional duties, and parental duties. I can't do any better than that. But I tell you what, it's a big step forward in my view. Okay, I'll take one more if anyone has not spoken yet. For yeah, please. That last question.
I'm just wondering about Ayana Lokin, he told, never says what God looks at, except in the case of war, where he bears our people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also noticing in the case of today that there is Vihine, there isn't a Kito there. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I'd be curious what your thought is behind that question. I mean, in other words, you're suggesting that it's not sort of implicitly clear that God is looking at what God has just made. Because the text says it about Or, but not about everything else, you think it means what exactly?
I'm just wondering, because you pointed out the difference between the sixth day and the other day. I'm wondering about that in light of the fact that God is not, it never says what God saw that he judged to be good, except in the case. So I'm just wondering how big is the difference there?
And I have to So the first one, I have to confess, it has never crossed my mind to think that it means anything other than that God had looked at everything God had made on that day and declared it very good. I have to think about that more. I don't know. It's like that question sort of hits at an angle that I never really thought about. And one of the ways in which you cause yourself problems when you try to read biblical texts the way I try to read them is you can't really say, or you can't say easily, I mean, it's just a figure of speech. Because literary readings get nervous about doing that. It reminds me of the time I once said to my psychoanalyst, by the way, I'm now Woody Allen, right? It reminds me of the time I said to my psychoanalyst, can I share a non sequitur? And then I just sort of said, wait a second, your entire universe is built on the fact that there are no non sequiturs. I guess I can share a non sequitur. So I don't know. The point is, thank you. I'm here every week. Fourth time. I don't know the answer to that. I have to say, like, I'm not totally convinced yet by the premise of the question that there's something significant there, but I want to think about it. Now, Vihine, I don't know. What does Vihine mean? I mean, I assumed that it meant there that God is taking in the entirety of the creation at that moment. And behold, it was all very good. If you're asking, is there some deeper additional theological meaning to the word vihine? I don't know. I guess I thought what the word hine did there, not so much in terms of the definition of the word, but in terms of its function in the verse, is to kind of bring under the umbrella all of what God had already made. Behold, all of it was very good. I don't know.
Right, but he might have said he there too, because we do have the parallel in or people.
Yeah, no, right. I don't know. I will think about both of your questions. I'm actually not really sure. So I think I just want to say, in conclusion here, that in a way I just really want to reiterate where I started, which is, first of all, what it means to take seriously as a theological, spiritual, and therefore interpersonal claim that no distinctions between human beings are ultimate or theologically significant. Now, you know, the students who are in the yeshiva for the year now heard me talk about something I've been thinking about in a very kind of undeveloped way. When the book of Proverbs, for example, says that rich person and poor person meet, and God made them both, right? The book of Proverbs is not saying there, I'm a radically socialist egalitarian text. The book of Proverbs is a fairly conservative text in certain ways. But it is saying wealth has no real significance. And that in itself is enough to put in our pipe and smoke for the rest of our lives. Because the fact is, whatever we say about how we think about that, we all fall prey to that. All of us. Right? I am more important than the guy who puts cream cheese on my bagel in the morning. I just am. Very few people in this room would say that sentence out loud. Very many people in this room, I suspect, have had moments of allowing it into consciousness to a greater or lesser degree. And I think the Bible comes along to say, to hell with all that. None of that is ultimate. And how would you live if you took that seriously? How would you live if you actually took human equality seriously? And by the way, I'm now to say this, I'm being a little inflammatory, right? No, but like, that doesn't mean that, oh, I walk away from an encounter and congratulate myself that I, the rich, wealthy, white person, don't look down on the poor Hispanic guy who makes my bagel. I'm very developed. I don't think I'm better than he is, right? But the fact is, I can't help but thinking about how congratulatory it is for me because out of my nobility, right, I'm not looking down at him. By the way, the giggles in this room tell us something very deep about ourselves. I say without any judgment. I'm implicated in this the same way anybody else is. But this is a very deep claim that Genesis is making. And also, look, power. Okay, let me just say something even more outrageous. Look, the Jewish community in its current iteration, right, one of its many idolatries is rich people. It is. One of Arthur Hertzberg's wonderful lines, Arthur Hertzberg used to say, I mean, this is a totally romanticized notion, but it's great. Arthur Hertzberg used to say, you know, I know that American Jewry is totally corrupt. In Eastern Europe, all the rich people used to line up outside the rabbi's door asking for 5 minutes of his time. And then we got here, and all the rabbis are trying to get the rich person to respond to one of their messages. That is so corrupt, it's breathtaking. So this insistence on whatever ways that we are tempted to sort of create hierarchies and imagine that they're ultimate, that Genesis 1 is a slashing of that. Right? And I'm talking about not just thinking, oh, the way, I mean, you know, I never get tired of saying this. The idea of encountering this text is not to sort of feel warm inside and say, isn't Judaism beautiful? Right? It's actually about sort of figuring out what it would mean to actually look at the world and people and God and creation differently. And it seems to me that that's part of the project of Genesis 1. It is the refusal of, to say it in gratuitously philosophical language, ontological hierarchies. There are no ontological hierarchies. They're just human beings. Now, the second piece, and with this I will end, the sentence that I have said more often than any other in my life, besides, I love you, Rachel. The sentence that I have said more often in my life than any other is that Judaism's dream is of a world in which human dignity is real and the presence of God is manifest. I think that if we take Genesis 1 seriously, we ought to consider revising that formulation such that Judaism's dream is a world in which human dignity is real, creation flourishes, and the presence of God is manifest. That's, I think, the theology of Genesis 1. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. We'll be davening Maariv here in a few moments. You're welcome to join if you want. There's Sidurim over there at the top table.
Oh, my life.
Yeah, that's a parallel bridge. I don't know.